This podcast is brought to you by WRFL, Radio Free Lexington. Find us online at WRFL.fm. Catch us on your FM radio while you're in Central Kentucky at 88.1 FM, all the way to the left. Thank you for listening, and please be sure to subscribe.
The current time is 6:33, and you are tuned in here. Joining me more through the magic of science than through the magic of actually being here in the room, it's Mitch.
That's right. Instead of me talking to you via the airwaves, I'm now talking to you via airwaves through airwaves. It's like science squared, everyone. But I want to thank you more importantly for tuning in and checking out with us this wonderful Thursday evening. We've got some interesting stuff lined up for you and hope that you have survived this past week with all of the crazy stuff that's been going on here in this great big world of ours.
I think you had an article that you wanted to start off with.
Sure, we can talk about this. This is something interesting. This will probably take up our entire segment for this first hour. Basically, what it is that there have been some talk about it before, and it's finally looks like it's taking a better step towards actually happening. Legislation last week calling for the creation of a space corps within the Air Force. So for those of you that don't know, we're going to talk a little bit about how the U.S. deals with its space programs. So the civilian side of things is managed by NASA, the National Aeronautic and Space Agency.
Which notably was spun out of the original military group. I can't think of what that acronym was.
It was called the... I believe it was the Aeronautic Corps or something like that. It's something aeronautic. That's where the aeronautics comes into the name.
NACA was the group before them, NACA, starting in 1915.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. Anyways, so basically that is the civilian branch of things. Everything civilian-related with the United States and space is run through NASA. Everything military-wise and run through space is handled by the Air Force as of right now. That just happens to be the jurisdiction that's fallen into. For example, originally the Air Force was the Army Air Corps, and it was deemed, okay, the air is too much for the leadership of the Army to handle on its own. We need to make its own branch. Just as the Coast Guard was split off from the Navy way back when into its own branch. So what we're looking at is that this House Armed Services Subcommittee called for the creation of a sub-corps within the Air Force, sort of like the Army Rangers or the Navy SEALs with the Navy, would be the Air Force Space Corps. And that would basically be a protection. The whole reason this is a problem or even being considered is that the Air Force for years has been receiving an allotment of money intended for space research and development for the military arm of the space, for lack of a better word, space agency. Seeing as NASA is the civilian space agency, the Air Force is sort of more or less the military space agency. So these funds have been diverted for different projects, et cetera, and that have been deemed more crucial instead of being used to research things like how can we better design rockets, how can we protect our infrastructure in space as opposed to militarizing it, how do we set up sort of a defensive grid in space to protect our satellites and communication systems, because a lot of our communication systems are heavily reliant on satellites. For example, Grant, correct me if I'm wrong, our cellular networks are run by the towers at the local level, but then the main communication hubs for the even the cellular networks get bounced up through via satellites, correct?
Mm-hmm. And there are satellite phones themselves, along with GPS. Yeah. There's a huge amount of infrastructure up there. And so certain elements of this, such as the communication protection network that they would put up to protect satellites, it could be used also, my understanding is, as kind of a National Guard thing as well, in response to natural disasters. Say if there was a large group of, you know, small meteors that move through, the kind of stuff that burns up in the atmosphere but would do damage to satellites, then we could...
They would be able to intercept and appropriately mitigate the damage.
Exactly.
From space. Naturally, in the past, this has been very... You know, a lot of people have been hesitant to even take that much of a step due to it... So this is leading up to this Space Corps that is basically being a designated sub-branch of the Air Force with which the intended funding for space-related projects that the Air Force is receiving will be funneled to, as opposed to being in sort of the Air Force's general budget that can be used elsewhere for different projects, et cetera, et cetera. It will finally have a protected use, if you will, a protected, you know, sub-branch that will oversee the dispensement of these research funds and development funds and whatnot. So that's definitely a very interesting thought that the United States may have a Space Corps soon.
Yeah, do you think that's reasonable to believe that we're going to have a Space Corps in as a military, a non-civilian branch here again in the future?
I mean, as I said, the House Subcommittee, the House Armed Services Subcommittee, has already approved a version of a bill out of committee, which will then pass the House floor itself for general debate, and that will obviously take some time to even go through that process. However, it has already come out of committee, and it's basically all it is just coming up with a sub-branch like the Army Rangers or the Navy SEALs, except it'll be the Air Force Space Corps. And, I mean, I definitely think that it'll happen, you know, sooner rather than later. As I said, it has become a problem that the Air Force has been using some of those funds that are meant for space-related research and development and technology deployment for uses that were not in, you know, don't fall under the category of space-related, such as, you know, taking some of those funds to pay for fighter jets, et cetera, maintenance and upkeep of other Air Force assets.
Yeah, yeah.
So I definitely think that, you know, some people are going to think this is a good idea to more or less make this sub-branch of the Air Force, transfer some people into it so you don't have to have a, because, you know, there's not going to be a big recruitment.
Yeah, yeah.
It's range.
It's really more just making it the official title that it was
extra,
already supposed to be.
Piece of military administration.
Yeah.
That's going to have a direct hand in overseeing how those funds are being spent.
Yeah.
As opposed to letting people dip into that pot that's meant for space-related things. Now, whether or not it'll be called the Space Corps, I don't know. I think that's a perfectly adequate name for it, you know. Better than being called the Air Force Space Cadets, you know.
I think it's a fitting name.
It is. So.
All right.
And they might be called the Space Force. Who knows? That would be pretty funny. The Air Force Space Force. So. That was the first main topic we wanted to cover tonight. Grant, do you have anything else you want to talk about during this segment, or do we want to head to a music break?
Let's take a break, swing through some music, see where it takes us. The current time is 6:44, and you were tuned in here to WRFL Lexington. We will be back here around 7 o'clock, a little bit thereafter probably. and we have more news happening in STEM, science and technology, coming your way here in just a few minutes. So until then,
keep it locked all the way to the left at your only alternative left, WRFL Lexington. And thanks again for tuning in and checking out with Tech Talks.
All right. We'll be back in just a few minutes. Welcome back. The current time is 7:02, and you were tuned in here to WRFL Lexington. Welcome back specifically to Tech Talks, a weekly technology talk show program that happens here every Thursday from 6 to 8 p.m.
That's right. I'm one of those hosts, Mitch, and I'm joined in, not in the studio, because I'm not in the studio, by my amazing other co-host,
Grant. That's me.
That's right, everyone.
So we'll be here for another hour or so, kicking around some music and talking about technology, so keep it locked. First up, we are under 2 months away from the August 21st total North American solar eclipse.
That's right.
So there's going to be one of the best visible solar eclipses in North America coming through in a little bit less than 2 months. It's going to be on August 21st, and that evening we will see a 70-mile-wide stretch of the U.S. from coast to coast, where there will be effectively a complete solar eclipse. And
that's pretty cool.
That happens to be passing through Kentucky is one of the cool things. Additionally, the everywhere in the continental United States will see some level of an eclipse. Maybe it won't be the fullest, purest eclipse, but it will be somewhere within the 500 or so mile radius that is considered at least a partial eclipse. So pretty much all of the U.S. will fall within that at some point that evening.
Mm-hmm.
And there's actually been a lot of talk back and forth because there are a handful of cities that are going to be really good for viewing. And cities like that happen to include places like Portland, Oregon, and Kansas City, and Nashville. Additionally, places here in Kentucky like Murray and Bowling Green and kind of that part of Kentucky in the southwestern part are going to be perfectly within that complete eclipse zone. And so there's actually already preparations happening at a state-by-state level because of the anticipation of all of these people that are going to flood to this part of the kind of the Midwest, really, coming here in a couple months, where a whole bunch of people are going to try to actually get within that 70-mile-wide stretch streak through the United States. I don't know. I'm a huge nerd, and I think it's crazy that we're getting the first, like, full continent solar eclipse in the last 99 years to happen.
Mm-hmm. It's always a neat thing whenever something happens in real life. It's going to be the first time in basically a century that this event has occurred. You know, think about it. When was the last thing that you heard that happened a century ago? You know, it's 2020. You know, a century ago, we just finished, or it's almost 2020. A century ago, we just got out of the First World War.
Yeah, yeah. The last time that the U.S. saw a solar eclipse like this, it was during World War One. Which is,
so I mean, it's just it's fascinating because you don't really think about it, you know, you whenever history is witnessed, you know, it's just something that sort of is like, oh, that's kind of cool, and then, you know, just years and years later on, you'll hear about it. It's something that you're going to be able to say, hey, I was alive and I saw that, you know. I don't know. It's just neat. I would classify it on the same category of, and remind me, if, or correct me if I'm wrong, but if I'm not mistaken, there was a point where there was a just weird weather phenomena happening in the United States, and down south, they were actually able to see the Aurora Borealis, which is a light phenomenon that is, you know, only capable of happening in the north, except for very specific
weather conditions.
Am I correct in that, or am I just, you know, incorrectly remembering that?
No, that's correct. I believe it was in South America they had some really phenomenal viewing when the jet
America,
stream
right.
pulled it north. The southern one pulled it north into South America.
Mm-hmm.
But this event, you know, last time it happened was 99 years ago. So we're talking about something that is a Halley's Comet once a lifetime kind of event.
Yeah.
So it's going to be an exciting event to see, and we're going to remind you again as you get closer in case that's something that you want to try to step out onto your back porch and see. You're going to have a great viewing angle. Keeping in mind that if you are here in Lexington and viewing, you won't technically be in a full eclipse space, so we do not advise that you stare directly into a sun, even during a solar eclipse, because we won't be within a full eclipse.
Yeah.
It'll look like a full eclipse, but there will be enough sunlight around one edge of it that it will still be damaging to stare at. But, yeah. That's everything I wanted to cover with this very cool event that we're going to be seeing here in August. There is...
Awesome. Well, I'm excited.
Yeah, yeah. Switching topics, there is a $250 million supercomputing contract that the Fed has just signed, and it's going across 6 companies: IBM, Intel, HP, AMD, Cray, and NVIDIA are all getting research contracts. And they're going to probably be stacking their own money on top of this. So cumulatively, this could be something like a $1 billion fund towards supercomputing. So that'll
be interesting.
That's pretty exciting.
And everyone hears about a supercomputer, and you're like, I don't know. I feel like a lot of people
get the wrong idea.
Think about it. I think so. I think that, you know, from my experience, supercomputing is actually a lot less mysterious.
I think it's also maybe a little less glamorous than people assume by the name.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep, I agree.
Yeah, I think there's this idea that, like, you get a whole bunch of computers together and then somehow it magically becomes really smart or something, and that's really not at all how that process works. It's for the most part a lot of very smart engineers getting together and fine-tuning a whole bunch of computers to play together as though they were one giant computer able to freely carry information through them. And so once you get to that point, the way in which you can crunch data is truly incredible. Speaking of this, I have another topic, but if you can give me a minute, Mitch, I will find it for you, because there's a topic about Google that I want to talk about. So
awesome. Sounds perfect.
Have you had any interesting interactions with supercomputers? Is that something that you've
Yes, actually. So there at the, you know, we're students at the University of Kentucky. There is, we have a supercomputer on campus. It's a clustered Linux-based system managed by one of the UK professors. And they are made up out of older computers, you know, things like what you would expect to see a Windows 95 on, you know, something like that. And, you know, you look at that and you think, okay, supercomputers supposed to be these awesome, cool, liquid-cooled, you know, things where circuits and lights are flying everywhere. And really, it doesn't necessarily have to. That's sort of been my experience with it. And it was not at all what I expected or seen in many of the sci-fi movies, you know. So I definitely think that when people think of supercomputing, there's a large misconception as far as what their perception is and what they actually will see.
Yeah, yeah. But as far as supercomputers that give you the bang for your buck that you expect, let's talk about Google's DeepMind. You may remember DeepMind if you've been hanging out with us for a while. DeepMind is a little bit of a jack of all trades in the artificial intelligence community. It is the program that learned how to play Go and was able to best Go players all around the world. It's been used and kind of reinvented into a whole bunch of different applications. But this year, Google took DeepMind and aimed it back at their own process. So Google has an initiative by which they're trying to go 100% renewable energy for their data centers. They've been putting lots of resources into green energy, and they've been doing a lot of inventing and getting creative, but there's only so far they've been able to take it. Even now, where they're getting 3.5 times more computing power per watt than they were 5 years ago, they're still not hitting the numbers that they want. And so they can always invest more and build more renewable energy, but alternatively, anytime they can get their power consumption down, they're also going to manage to improve that ratio. So as far as that goes, they put DeepMind on it. They had this neural network hooked up, and they just let it observe they let it just observe the happenings inside of their data center. And after a few weeks, a few months of learning the ins and outs of this data center, just by having this computer hooked up in kind of an observation mode, it was ready, it was confident. The computer itself expressed confidence in being ready to take on the data center. And when it did, it found ways to reduce the amount of energy needed for cooling by 40%.
Wow.
It's the biggest single step in power reduction that they've ever taken.
That's impressive.
It was a number that blew me away. And so, of course, the ideas that it generated aren't necessarily the kind of things that can apply to any data center anywhere, but there are some interesting takeaways that it made. But really, the interesting thing is that you could take this software and put it on a computer that's strong enough to crunch however much data it needs from your data center, and likewise, it could generate some reasonably similar suggestions about how to reduce power waste and how to reduce cooling and energy needs. And it's really impressive to me how successful it was.
That is definitely a very impressive thing. You know, it's not something that you really see very often. That I mean, 40% pop. you know? It's just mind-boggling that it's, you know, just a supercomputer observing was able to come up with that and be like, hey, you can knock all this off if you do what I say.
Yeah, yeah. And so it came up with a model that would kind of be like how if you have a programmable thermostat in your home, how you can set it to different settings based on different days and different times. It came up with some suggestions that look and read kind of like that as far as the particular ins and outs of the couple of data centers they've tried this on. But it's impressive to me how quickly it was able to analyze this information and, you know, because there's no single engineer in the world that could show up to a data center and figure out in the span of a couple months how to drop their power usage like that by basically just playing with a thermostat a whole bunch. It's really quite a feat to me. Wow, I'm just I'm gonna be linking to this article over on our Facebook page because it's such a fascinating story to me of how successful machine learning can be. And I think it shows that there's a lot of promise for this application because not only does that, I mean, think about it. Not only does it mean that Google's saving money, but it means that they can pass those savings on to their cloud services and the people that rent time on their cloud computing and all of that kind of things. And so if you were to implement this on a large scale, there's so much potential for this to be used as a diagnostic tool and everywhere from data centers to just everyday offices. You know, any place where people are paying their own utility bills, even in people's homes, in theory, you know, there's this idea that it could analyze how to balance comfort and energy savings in a way that works. I don't know. And this is just something that's really exciting to me.
Comfort and economy. Yep. I agree.
So their next goal for DeepMind? You want to know?
Sure, yeah.
They want to chop 10% off of the entirety of the UK's energy consumption per day. So they just want to slice off a tenth of all of the power used in the United Kingdom on a daily basis by using this tool over and over and over at every different factory, at every different data center, at every different office. They want to roll this out into everywhere and get the energy and get the energy consumption of a whole country measurably down. It's a big goal.
It is. I'm going to be really curious to see how much they can implement that.
I wish them the best in this. I hope this really, really works out for them.
Because if they do, it's going to be... It's like if you've seen commercials for like that earthhour.org, how... For 1 hour, maybe once a month, all the big national monuments from member countries, like they'll turn off the lights on the Eiffel Tower, on the Capitol, and things like that. The Statue of Liberty, big national monuments across the world, and they'll turn the power off for 1 hour, like a month, because it'll save so much energy.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think it's something similar to that, you know.
So a couple of statistics about data center power while we're kind of on the topic. From 2000 to 2005, energy usage, which is now at over 70 billion kilowatt hours, which is 6 million homes worth of... So you could power 6 million homes for a year, and that's how much energy is getting used by U.S. data centers per year right now. So the curve, though, has been leveling off. It from 2000 to 2005, it jumped by 90%. And then from 2005 to 2010, it jumped by another 25%. But then from 2010 to 2015, it only climbed by 5%. So we're seeing this leveling off of how much energy we're using in data centers. And so the idea is that if Google could really get this implemented and really put it in all of their factories, then they might actually see the power consumption in data centers in the U.S. go down instead of up next year. And that would just, that would be shocking to the industry to be able to make that happen.
Yeah, definitely.
I don't know. This is very fun to me. I think there's a lot of potential here, but we'll keep you updated if anything else comes through our way. In the meantime, the current time is 7:22, and you were tuned in here to WRFL Lexington. Isn't that right, Mitch?
That's right. More specifically, you're tuned in to Tech Talks here, and we want to thank you for tuning in and checking out with us, and we will see you all in a little bit.
All right. Current time is 7:35. You were tuned in here to WRFL Lexington. That last track that you just heard was by Alt J. With this, it is coming up on 8 o'clock. I know it's not quite 8 o'clock yet, but we're going to go ahead and call it a wrap on this episode of Tech Talks. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for keeping it locked all the way to the left. Coming up next, we're actually, I think Chris Wright is going to be filling in, so it should be a really cool show. I think it's going to be pretty fun. But we will see you next week, Mitch.
That's right, everyone. We will see you next week. Thank you for tuning in and checking out with us. As always, if you have any comments, questions, or concerns, you can immediately call the on-air DJ at 859-257-WRFL. And if you have anything specific that you want to pass on to Grant and myself, feel free to follow us on on Facebook. You can like our page and see all the articles that we talk about on air, and we'll get posted there. You can also message us. We are very responsive. Anytime you have questions, or even if you want to suggest an article for us to talk about on air, we absolutely love those kind of interactions with our listeners. And you can also get a hold of us at WRFL Tech Talks, all one word, all lowercase, TEKTALKS. At gmail.com for more specific stuff. So feel free to reach out to us. We look forward to hearing from you.
All right. With that, we will see you next week. Be sure to keep it locked here for great tunes up to the end of the hour and every hour here on WRFL.
Hey there. If you're enjoying this podcast from WRFL Lexington, you may enjoy our live radio stream at WRFL.fm, and of course via radio at 88.1 FM in the Central Kentucky area. We have a wide variety of programs you're sure to enjoy. Just go to WRFL.fm/schedule and see what programs appeal most to you. Thanks again for listening to this podcast from WRFL Lexington.